Welcome to Fat Chicks on Top. This podcast contains frank discussions about the body, sexuality, and occasionally uses swear words, which may not be appropriate for people under the age of 18. This podcast also uses facts, statistics, and mathematics, which may not be appropriate for liberal arts majors. And this podcast relies on science and reality, which may not be appropriate for evangelicals. Welcome to the show. You are here with your host, Auntie Vice. It's good to be back. And today I have probably the most recommended author when it comes to books on dominance that I have recommended in my class, one that I love his writing and his work. We have Anton Fulman joining us today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here and honored to hear that you like my book.
I do. So I wanted to have you on the show because I have a lot of people who work in sex education, kink education, but the vast majority of them come from the submissive side. And that's what gets talked about more when it comes to everything from triggers to safety and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
We leave people out on a limb a little more in discovering dominance. So you've obviously written from that. But before we get into all of your work, how did you discover you wanted to do consensual dominance?
Oh, I am primary paraphilic that way. It was the only thing that engaged my libido since I had a libido. I was fortunate to have a pretty decent upbringing. I have a great mom. She tried to teach me well. Hurting girls is bad. Don't try to dominate people. And I, as like a little kid, tried, right? I tried to have good fantasies and it didn't work. Right? So I don't know why I am that way. I just am. I'm oriented towards power and control for anything that's going to feel exciting and sexy. And not necessarily on the dominant side, right? But towards DS in general.
So there are a lot of folks out there who had similar upbringings. I give my partner, I joke with him that he doesn't want to hit a girl no matter how much I beg. Because he was raised, you don't hit girls, you don't call them names, you're very consensual, right? And this is how a lot of people are raised. So how did you start to deal with uncoupling what you had been taught about being a good man and how you're supposed to treat people to understanding that you could do this in a fun, sexy, and consensual way?
Yeah, let's say like refining rather than uncoupling, right? Because I think that's a great way to raise a kid. And I think that don't try to hurt people, don't try to dominate them is what we hope that people learn growing up. And that what I've found in consensual DS isn't like unlearning that, it's learning sort of nuanced levels on top of it around, you know, it's not really hurting somebody if you're doing it in a way that works really well for them and that they want and that they're going to be happy about. It's hurting, but it's a different meaning of the word hurting, right? And that consensual dominance is very, very different from non-consensual dominance, from patriarchy, from all of the isms that we live with, that it works when it's fundamentally based on not dominating people, on listening to what they really want and helping them get to it, and they're helping you get to what you want, and you're doing it together, you know, in that basic level that I hope people are teaching their young children, it's not really dominating. It's consensual. It's cooperative. And I found that in part because I had to, because it was the only way I was going to be able to get my libido to work, in part. So I kept thinking about it and, you know, chewing on it and looking for, you know, for any sort of examples or models I could. I found it in large part through the fortune of finding partners who would be like, hey, hit me, please. Right. And really invite me to lean into it and to explore it. And I found it through community, through finding models, right? Even, you know, when I was first going to college, they invented something called an internet. Even before the World Wide Web existed, you could find Society of Janus on Gopher. It was a thing that happened before the World Wide Web. You could find it on Usenet. And so you could start seeing models of, oh yeah, people are doing this and they're having a good time and they're living a good life and they're, you know, enhancing one another's lives. And that was invaluable for me.
So you bring up Society of Janus. We haven't talked a lot about them on the show, but they're kind of a core fundamental group in the kink world. So why don't you explain what Society of Janus is?
Sure. Society of Janus is a primarily education and consent, education and community organization around BDSM. They're the second longest running such organization that we know of. They are based in San Francisco and they were started in 1974. So they're 2 years older than I am. And they do classes, they do parties, they do munches, they have a Discord server, they provide a place where people can connect around kink, can learn about it, can get an entryway. Janus is the Roman god of portals, and that's an intentional double entendre, I think. It's the portal to the kink community, and they're really into putting things in holes, you know. So yeah, it's existed since the 70s. It runs on this like wonderful 70s model where there's no real like leader figure. There's not even a board. There's just a meeting once a month and whatever members show up make the decisions, like really directly a society run by those who show up. And it's worked, you know, it's worked for over 50 years.
50 years exactly, because I'm 74, yeah, so exactly. I'll be 50 this year.
Yeah. I hope they have a big anniversary party.
Me too. They're a wonderful group. For our listeners, I'll have a link in the show notes so that you can find their stuff and connect. Tons of resources. So when you're finding this and you're finding out about dominance, was it different than the models that are out now? Because kink has really expanded in what's out there, what people can access.
What I do the most of, sort of my niche, which is I'm a cis straight man. I'm mostly taking the dominant role in my dynamics. That was always there because that's actually mainstream, right? Like the only thing that's actually kinky about consensual cis white male dominant is the consensual part. All the rest is just normal. So that was there. What's been interesting is seeing how other options have gotten more airtime, right? That when I started, there was less space for other kinds of gender expression, other different vectors of power, other expressions that didn't look as much like the sort of stereotype of dominant in a black leather vest with a whip and, you know, the sort of basic image you have of what DS looks like. I think there's a lot more sort of different flavor available now.
You bring up consent, your book is Consensual Dominance. You write a lot about consent, and coming from a straight cis male side, what does that look like? I'm queer. Quite a few folks I've had on have talked about it more from the queering aspect, but as a straight guy, what does it look like when you start talking about true consensual dominance?
It takes a lot of unlearning, right? Because there is this very well-worn, very easy to access path to dominance that's not really based on consent for people like me. It's just because the whole world is set up so that we're sort of in charge, and people are kind of conditioned from birth that when, you know, the old white guy with the beard talks, they shut up and listen, you know, all of that stuff. And you can very easily just sort of roll into that. And you see a lot of people who do roll into that and sort of think that they're like born to be a true master. And you're like, actually, no, dude, that's just privilege. That's everybody who looks like us. But if you do, it comes with downsides. It comes with big pit traps that you fall into, because we can so easily roll over people that they're not really happy. They're not really getting what they want. There's, you know, you can very easily trigger people's fawn response, and they'll tell you that, yes, they're consenting, but they're not really getting what they want exactly. And eventually that sort of bubbles up into resentment. And so you see a lot of cis male poppy people who have an easy time getting partners with their like big hot I'm a dom guy routine, and then they lose partners, right? Because they're not really satisfying their partners, and so they cycle through them, boom 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 boom, one after another, which is hurtful for their partners, and I think also not satisfying for them. So yeah, the trick is that you've got this very easy to see, easy to follow path laid out in front of you, but it's not really a great path. It's some internal work to sort of see the other options, to see past it, right? To try to choose other things that are maybe a little harder, but actually can go deeper and be more reliable and more satisfying. I guess that's the short answer. And we owe a lot to the queer folk who are figuring out new models, because that gives you another example to look at, right? Like, oh, I could do something more like that.
So you talk about all of this kind of systematic privilege that comes with certain identities. And I think that's one of the conversations we had, in the kink community, we've talked about black and white relationships. We haven't really branched off into many other dynamics, but black and white relationships, a little bit about male and female relationships. But what does it take to recognize where you have privilege? Just not meaning that you've had it an easy time getting through life, but that systematically there's certain things that you haven't had to think about. How have you become aware of issues that you may need to consider when you're going into a dominant and submissive relationship?
Oh, I feel like there's a lot of answers to this question, to that question, and none of them are complete, right? How do you, I mean, is, you could just say empathy, but that's not a very actionable answer, is it? Listening to, reading stories of people who are in different positions of privilege. So the more you can sort of try to get those other perspectives, that helps. Finding those pit traps that exist in the sort of heteronormative male dominant paradigm, like you're starting to notice that system isn't really set up for cis men to be fulfilled and happy either. It's set up for us to be in power, but that's different, right? So if as the cis guy, if I can start to notice the ways that I'm not really being fulfilled by this script that's been laid out for me, that is a way to start opening the doors to other options. Again, maybe in a way, everybody's actually selfish, right? We want to increase our happiness. And so if we just tell people, you have to not do this because it's bad, but you know, you have all these privileges, you just have to give them up, that's not a very good pitch, but it's also not the full truth, right? The full truth is there's a deeper level of happiness that you can reach for yourself by finding ways to be truer to what you really need instead of your assigned role in society, and to have more mutual relationships with people who are close to you.
Well, and you bring up identifying what you really need. And I don't think we teach straight cis men to have that conversation with themselves. How did you, so you talked about how you need a power dynamic to really get the sexy aspect going. How did you figure out what you actually need? Because I know so many men around your age, straight men around your age, that haven't done that and haven't, they're unhappy, but they can't tell you why or what they might need.
Yeah, that's another big question, isn't it? I think kink helps with that, because even though cis male dominant kink is pretty much in line with the mainstream, you're still not supposed to use whips. Like, you're still sort of stepping off the script a little bit, and stepping off the script a little bit helps you to see that you can step off, that there's something outside the script. And because it exposes you to all the other people who are doing kink in different ways, and you can start to think like, oh, well, I might want to taste this. I might go over here. And yeah, maybe in ways it's the same answer as the last one, right? As the last question, you look at perspectives other than your own. Really go out of your way to read what's been written, or jump in, or listen in on the conversations for people who are at different positions of privilege.
You bring up reading a lot and listening to other people. What have been the sources for you where you've drawn on that?
There's also a lot. Yeah. Some things that I've read that I found really interesting recently, specifically around kink and power exchange. There is a super cool, I'm going to say new, but my brain is bad at time. It's probably actually been out for years now. There's a book called Hurt So Good that is are you familiar?
Yeah.
It's this great study of pain for pleasure, not just in like a BDSM sense, but in a like spread out to connect it to everything from ballerinas to ultra runners to hot pepper eaters, that I thought was really insightful about understanding what is up behind masochism. Another more recent book called Please Scream Quietly. If you're familiar, it's by Julie. Okay. I've only read her name. I haven't heard her name. So it's Julie Fennell, or maybe Fennell. I'm not sure.
Okay, I've seen the name. Yeah.
But it's a sort of ethnography of the kink scene, particularly around the mid-Atlantic of the US, that's neat because she does a lot of actual, like, it's not just her perspective. It's a bunch of research she uses questionnaires and interviews to bring together a lot of different perspectives on like what people are actually doing and how it's changed.
So the other part about this that we often don't talk about is to get actual consent from all partners. There's a lot of talking, and we often don't teach men in our society how to have extended conversations. Like, you know, little girls go off and they have all of these talking things. Boys play differently generally. What did it take to get really comfortable having the conversations? Because some of them are easy, some of them are not so easy with partners. You know, for you, just how'd you get comfortable with all that communication?
Man, have I gotten comfortable with that? I feel like I'm working on it. Practice is a big part of it. Finding partners who are ready or willing to engage ready and able to engage with you on that also, because I think that's something that actually most people don't get a good grounding in. I mean, maybe it's somewhat better for folks who are raised as little girls and than people who are raised as little boys. But in my experience, everybody's sort of grasping for how to have good intimate communication. I got a lot out of and continue to get a lot out of the nonviolent communication track and their methodology, both in terms of specific tools to learn and use, and also as a way to see what the possibility is, right? To look at a model and say, like, oh, there's, like, I feel like I started out not even knowing what it was I needed to learn about having deep and productive conversations, and just seeing, you know, people talking about how they solved these different problems and were able to, you know, improve their skill in these different ways was helpful, just in being like, oh, I didn't even know that was a problem, or that skill was possible.
I think that comes up for a lot of us, because this is a continuing lifelong journey with kink. And part of that is discovering what your limits are. Most of the conversations represented in the wider kink world is that bottoms, or people on the right side of the slash, have limits, because we're the ones who could get more physically hurt and all that. But dominants have limits. And so let's talk about a little bit about finding your limits as a dominant and communicating those.
Yeah. That's important. You're right. Like, everybody's got limits. Nobody is Superman. And I think we are often held up by the romanticization of no limits, like this sort of, it's, which is a very romantic idea, right? Wouldn't you love to be able to just do whatever you wanted? But I mean, even just physically, we all have limits. And so it's a great sort of, if taken lightly and with some understanding, it can be a kind of fun kind of a fantasy. But I think we often, yeah, our sort of kink culture takes it too seriously and tries to be too literal about being limitless. And yeah, there's a lot of pressure for people who want to dominate to, like, we're supposed to be able to dish out anything, basically, right? We're always supposed to be above and bigger than, and, you know, if we have any kind of limit to our capacity, it should be so far beyond the bottomy person that they never have to worry about it or think about it, right? Is the romantic ideal. And that's impossible. I think, you know, if you practice kink long enough, you bump into those limits, and if you aren't able to talk about them, you start having bad experiences. And there's your motivation, right? Is that you would like to stop having bad experiences. You've got to learn to be straightforward and upfront and clear about, like, okay, this is too much for me. Whether that's a practical thing, like a limit of skill, because often people who are on any sort of top-ish side are getting pushed to do things that maybe they're not actually confident doing. Right. And that can lead to bad times for everybody and injury for the bottom. And emotional limits, right? Like, we on the top side are often also supposed to have a very two-dimensional cardboard set of emotions. We're supposed to be always cold and controlling or whatever, right? Always ravenous and sadistic. And we're not. We are human beings. We have a range of feelings that include things like insecurity and sadness and, like, needing to be cuddled. And so we're often pushed by partners to not acknowledge those. And yeah, you have to find the courage to stand up for yourself and speak those limits and only settle for partners who are going to really honor them. And maybe one of the key insights is that kink conversations around kink often come with a deep and unstated assumption that the top wants every bottom, right? The top like consent is for bottoms, because why would a top need to not give consent? Because the top always is a yes, that, you know, you should be able to dominate everybody and you should want to dominate everybody. And there isn't a lot of space there for dominance being sort of choosy, or at least choosy in ways other than like, you aren't enough bottom for me, so I will take the bottom of your bottom, to be able to really stop and think about your own consent, just in the like, do I want to do this? Do I want to do this with this person? And once you start thinking about whether or not you want to do this as like a real question that you might be able to say no to, your limits start to show up, because you're like, oh, yeah, I mean, this person will do all the kink things that are on my list of kink things, but, you know, they aren't nice to me. I don't want to do that. You know, you start checking with your heart, and your heart is like, eh, no. That's where you start to find your like feelings limits.
I love that you bring that up, because that is so rarely talked about in the kink world, is that even if the person who's approaching you may do all of the fun and dirty things you want, there's more to it for dominance. There's an emotional connection with dominant. A lot of people can kind of envision how bottoms or subs get pleasure, right? Because things are being done to us. For a lot of folks, it's a lot harder to understand, how do you get pleasure from spanking somebody or calling them names? So for you, where does that joy and that pleasure come from?
Yeah, I think there's a few things mixed all in together there. For me, and I see that mix in different proportions when I look carefully at other people and their dynamics. I think there's, you know, if we're talking about dominance proper, right, like control, authority, power, there's a tremendous ego rush in it, right? And I'll admit that, that you get to feel so big. You get to feel in charge. It satisfies a bunch of the kind of patriarchal goals that are set. They're not just, and also sort of capitalism goals, the sort of the dominator culture. That's what I want. The dominator culture goals that are supposed to make you feel successful, of like getting to boss everybody around and be in charge. And that feels good. And, you know, you can take that good feeling in sort of an unhealthy addict sort of way, or you can kind of come to wrap your head around it and come to terms with it and not need to be the dominator and dominator culture anymore, but still have fun playing with it, right? That's big for me. There is a lot of, in all kinds of topping, there's a lot of pleasure available in feeling good at something. Like, there's a lot of technique in topping, and you can be an expert at tying people up or at whipping them, and that's fun. It's fun to develop the skill. It's really satisfying to, you know, it to then practice the skill and have people be all impressed by what a good job you did. That's fantastic. And there's, you know, for a lot of people around DS, there's a lot of attraction just to structure in their lives, like especially if we're talking about long-term throughout the relationship DS, that it gives you a framework for relating that can be very, very safe for some folks, right? And very smooth, and like they just have a better relationship when there's a structure about who gets to decide what and how to take care of it if there's any disruptions to the relationship. And I'm just giving a smattering here, right? It's sort of like you say, you know, why do people like making art? Well, they like making art for all kinds of reasons, right? But there's some big ones. But if we tried to make just like a bulleted list, it will never be a complete list. But one other thing that I think is interesting that I want to point out is that there can be horse trading. There could be a lot of like, I do this thing and then you do this thing I like, right? And or that feels good for me. That there can be like, I'm going to give my partner this spanking because my partner is just over the moon about getting spanked and it's very physically, sensually pleasurable for them. And then I'm going to be the big dominant and I'm going to be like, now you give me oral sex for as long as I want. And then they're not only going to do it, they're going to be like all slavishly devoted and enthusiastic about doing it. And that's going to be fantastic for everybody, right? That often in general, kinks don't have to perfectly line up so that all the partners involved equally directly enjoy all of them. You can find ways to intermingle your pleasures so that each person is getting what they want and giving what the other person wants.
And I like that you bring up that they don't have to align. A lot of people, especially newer to kink, will have a list of, you have to have all these things to line up. And I've even seen now on FetLife and some of the other social sites of, please fill up this application to be my submissive and prove that you can do all the things, right?
Which can be its own kind of little role play that people do, right? It can be sexy to be like, oh, I have to apply, and then they'll choose whether they accept me or not. Oh my goodness.
But they don't have to perfectly align in any way. And the other thing that I like is, you've been in this long enough to know that things change, limits change, desires change.
Yeah.
As you've aged, how have things changed for you?
Certainly my toy bag has just shrunk and shrunk over time. When I first got to get involved in like a in-person public kind of kink community, the thing that everybody did was flogging. It's like rope is now. You went to a party, there would be a line of crosses along the wall. There would be a line of bottoms on each cross. There would be a line of tops on each bottom. Whap, 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 away with the floggers. And so I got a flogger because that's what tops did. And I learned to flog, and it took me, I don't know, a few years to realize that it just didn't interest me at all, actually. And to sort of start getting deeper into what I really want instead of the kind of what everybody's doing, the cookie cutter image of what a top does. And that has been a continuing trend where like, I don't have a lot of equipment I use at this point. It's because and this took me a while, I've narrowed down that what I'm really interested in is the DS. It's the playing with authority. That wasn't apparent to me at first, right? I had these images in my head. I had these stories I read and I knew they were sexy and they involved authority and they involved spanking and they involved chains and they involved all these things. And I knew that like that stuff was sexy. But it's not like I automatically understood exactly what part of it was sexy. I had to try it all for a while. it's been a big focusing process for me of figuring out just what the bit is that is really the core of what I'm into.
And you bring up that, you know, there's always a trend of what is the popular play, right? And rope it. We started this season with Mixed Bliss talking about rope and bondage and all of that, and how suspension used to be a very edge play thing.
Yeah.
Now it's very centralized. There's a lot of pressure, especially as you're coming into the community, to develop skills around whatever is popular.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of folks have a desire to fudge their resume for how skilled they, because it takes a while to develop these skills.
Yeah.
I know, especially if you're, you know, a cis guy, to admit that, no, I don't really know what I'm doing here can be very tricky.
Yeah.
So what would you say to folks out there who have that need to kind of fudge their resume of their skills as a dominant?
Yeah. The big thing is that while it's really hard to believe this, you will get so far with humility. I'm not just telling you should do it. I'm telling you it works. That if you walk into spaces where you might find partners around kinky stuff and you're the person who says, hey, you know, I'm learning and I'm exploring, and are you interested in starting small and learning and exploring with me? It tends to result in people feeling like they are safe with you, and people feeling like it's not intimidating to connect with you, and off you go. And then you can learn with people, right? Whereas trying to fudge your way, while it feels less vulnerable because you don't have to admit that you don't know things, you actually don't get as far with people. And then also, of course, you end up getting in over your head and getting into situations where you hurt somebody, or you just don't give them the time that they expected you to give them. And then they start, you know, telling their friends about that, and it goes south.
It really can. I want to touch on briefly aftercare for a dominant or a top. Because mm-hmm. that aftercare is almost completely focused on the submissive.
So yeah.
Do tops, do dominant need aftercare in general?
In general, yeah. You know, I think kink tends to be an intense and a vulnerable experience for everybody involved, and that we should always expect that it's not just gonna, you know, come to a rapid end and everything goes on as though nothing had happened. And that, yeah, people on the toppy side often want, need, benefit from some kind of denouement to kinky things we do, and that it's very individual. You know, the other thing that I often notice about aftercare is that there's a lot of very strong tropes about what aftercare is, right? And that in reality, different people need different things and need different things at different times. And, you know, instead of having your aftercare bag with all the things that you're gonna have available for your partner after a scene, you should be better to just have like a couple hours and that you don't have anything else planned, and you're going to talk with them afterwards about what they actually need. But I think often people who are topping, dominating, after they've had a intense experience, they want reassurance that their partner knows they're a good person and, you know, doesn't think they're actually a big evil monster. Sometimes what people want is like a gradual coming down from the power high, where they're still treated with some exaggerated respect and deference for a while afterwards. And it feels really like dropping to be like, okay, the collar came off, so screw you now. You know, I'm going to go back to being sort of dismissive or very independent. So, you know, those two sets of needs might be pretty different, and you got to figure out which, right?
Well, and I've found the longer you have a relationship with somebody in a DS setting, the more that evolves and the more you really understand what each other needs.
Yeah, hopefully.
And for me, that's where a lot of the bonding comes in. Like, I'm into more of the extreme degradation, humiliation, mm-hmm. that type of stuff. Love it, but to come back and just light his cigarette and sit at his feet and mm-hmm. tell him, you know, yeah, I know you still respect me, even though you just called me all of these horrible things, and thank you for that, because that was really hot, you know?
even though, and perhaps more because of,
right?
Yeah. Talking briefly about power exchange gets really complicated for me because I think so many things are very different in those different in like the long-term bonded relationship context versus the occasional play partner context versus the pickup play at a conference context, right? That, and I can often, I think I can tell what context people are assuming when they do write about power exchange. They'll write something like, you know, you absolutely must schedule an aftercare session after every scene. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably true if you're doing pickup play at a conference. Whereas in my long-term bonded relationship, the relationship is our aftercare. Like that reassurance that, you know, we still care about one another and that we respect one another and that we are going to support one another is like the fact that we are married.
Where do you find joy in kink?
Oh, all over. I guess one big place that I find joy in kink is in the seeing people and myself get the freedom to access their passions fully and on their own terms, right? That's when it's really working well. That's what I see, is that it is a way for people to escape from a whole lot of shoulds and scripts and prescriptions about what you ought to want and what sex ought to be and what relationships ought to be and what, you know, passion and joy ought to be, and really let themselves get closer to what it is for them.
What are you currently grateful for?
Also many things. I will go with, I am currently in and always grateful for the excellent people who have chosen to submit to me and the devotion that they give me and the way that they let me access and play with this like fucked up kinky dominant desire that is like something that nobody ever really has a right to do to people, but that I get to do because they so want me to do it to them.
That's fantastic. If our listeners want to find your book, if they want to take a class from you, if they want to connect with you, plug all your sites.
You can find all of my educational stuff in one place on the website. That's consensualdominance.com. That's got all my books and a bunch of essays. Whenever I feel like writing something, it goes up there. And if and when I do classes, they'll go out through, I'll announce them on a mailing list that you can find on that site. You can follow me as Mr. Fullman on FetLife too, if you want. Similarly, whenever I do any educational, professional kind of stuff, I will I'll mention it there.
And listeners, we'll have all those links and more in the show notes. Thank you so much for being on the show. It was wonderful to connect with you.
My pleasure. Thanks for chatting.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Fat Chicks on Top. Please like, subscribe, and review our podcast on whatever platform you listen to it on. If we like your review, we may even read it online. This has been an Auntie Vice production. Producer and host, Rebecca Blanton.
Audio production by Sharon Smith. Music by David Manga. And more music by Sharon Smith. For more information about Fat Chicks on Top, please visit our website for all things Fat Chicks at fatchicksontop.com.